in our communities and around the world, right here on 89.3 WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Listening to WHFR Dearborn. We are the station making waves. It is 1 o'clock and it is time for Impact, a public affairs talk program where we feature a nonprofit organization within a community or around the world that is trying to make an impact in today's society and change the world for the better. But this time on Impact, what we're going to feature here is actually a segment from Peace Talks Radio. In this segment in this next hour, you're going to hear about two organizations that are working in conflict-ridden parts of the world. Both are dedicated to nonviolent methods of protecting civilians, human rights workers, and facilitating dialogue between the conflicting sides. In this program, you'll hear host Carol Boss talk with three people affiliated with the nonprofit organization Peace Brigades International, and also the former director of the Nonviolent Peace Force, who is Mel Duncan. Both of these organizations make use of unarmed accompaniment and other peacemaking strategies to help support people doing peace and human rights work in places like Colombia, Guatemala, Sri Lanka, and the Philippines. So I really hope you enjoy this, and you are listening to 89.3 WHFR.FM, the station making waves.
Today on Peace Talks Radio, we explore what impact unarmed peacekeeping bodyguards could be having in helping human rights defenders in conflict-ridden hotspots around the globe.
Human rights defenders, just having a foreign volunteer with them was some level of protection, because whether it was dictators or death squads, they really didn't want to carry out attacks right in front of the international community with us watching.
Doctor, they call lawyers doctor in Colombia. And he just bursts into tears because he's so overwhelmed by seeing these people that he hasn't been able to see in so long, that he's been terrified to go back and see in person. It was just a gorgeous moment that I think typifies what we're there to do, which is allow people to do the work that they want to be doing so that their country can move forward.
The work of Peace Brigades International and the Nonviolent Peace Force, today on Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution strategies. This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. We put the spotlight on peacemakers throughout history and today. Whether it's the search for inner peace, or learning how to resolve conflicts we have with others in our families, workplaces, communities, or between nations, we consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. In conflict-ridden nations like Colombia, Guatemala, Indonesia, Mexico, Nepal, the Philippines, and Sri Lanka, the disputes between rival factions are complex, to say the least. But in all these places and more, there's a common desire among many civilians and international observers that, despite the disputes, basic human rights be respected, violence curtailed, and that disagreements be negotiated fairly. In some of these regions, the temptation is high among armed factions to simply eliminate, capture, or kill people who are working to defend human rights and who are lobbying for peaceful solutions to complex issues. And if no one else is watching, someone can be disappeared, and no one can be fingered as responsible. Today on Peace Talks Radio, we'll explore two international non-governmental organizations which employ unarmed bodyguards into such regions to neutrally accompany human rights defenders who are working to give peace a better chance. In 2005, we talked with Mel Duncan of the group known as the Nonviolent Peace Force about its work in civil war-ravaged Sri Lanka. We'll get an update from him later. But first, our Carol boss sits down with three members of another non-governmental organization called Peace Brigades International, or PBI. PBI Executive Director Catherine Hughes Freytek, current PBI volunteer Dana Brown, who recently returned from a fieldwork stint in Colombia, and Liam Mahoney, a longtime specialist in civilian protection and human rights, who's worked with PBI and other groups in Guatemala, El Salvador, Sri Lanka, Colombia, and elsewhere.
Liam, you began working with Peace Brigades International in Guatemala in the 1980s. What were the circumstances that led to the creation of this organization?
Well, it was interesting. It started before they ever went to Guatemala. It was actually created at a conference of peace activists from all over the world that just basically drawing on inspiration from Gandhi, were trying to create an institution that could send in teams of volunteers anywhere in the world where there was a place where people needed some kind of support for addressing conflict. And that happened to be in the beginning of the 80s when Central America was really one of the hottest places around. And so the first places they explored after founding it in 1981 were Guatemala and El Salvador. So they went down and found a lot of people who really thought, you know, having an international team there to support them would be helpful, and started up this first team. I didn't join it till about 4 or 5 years later.
Catherine, if you could talk about, if you can explain the basic philosophy and the mission of PBI, Peace Brigades International.
Sure, Carol. Basically, our basic philosophy is based on nonviolent strategies and philosophies to deal with conflict resolution. We believe that nonviolence is much more effective, actually cost-effective as well, and efficient for long-term peace than any kind of war or violence would be. Our vision, which is very broad, is that Peace Brigades International envisions a world in which people address conflicts nonviolently, where human rights are universally upheld, and social justice and international respect have become a reality. We know we're a ways off achieving that, but that's our vision. And we work with what we call protective accompaniment, and we can describe that a bit more in detail. But we have international observers and well-trained volunteers and teams on the ground in countries of conflict. And we work to protect human rights defenders that are at risk, peacemakers that are working in their local communities to focus on peace and justice in their communities.
Well, I think it's a good time now to describe for listeners what an accompanier is and also a human rights defender.
And I think the idea of accompaniment is fundamentally first starts with our belief that it's local people in these conflicts that are going to do the most to change things. So what we've tried to do in developing accompaniment is figure out, how do we give them the space to do it? How do we protect them so they can actually take risks and try to change this, the terrible things going on in their own societies? And what we found, starting way back in Guatemala in 1983, was that just having a foreign volunteer with them was some level of protection, because whether it was dictators or death squads or whoever was out to get them, they really didn't want to carry out attacks right in front of the international community with us watching. Now, as far as who those activists are, human rights defender is actually a recent term that's been developed. But the whole idea is these are people in civil society who are trying to organize change in their own society to change dynamics of human rights abuse and conflict. Whoever's taking those risks, we're trying to strategize and work together with them to figure out where can we place an international presence and place international pressure outside most effectively to keep them safe so they can keep on doing their work.
Can you describe more fully the scenario in Guatemala when this model was, essentially developed? What happened when the team members, the people who were being protective accompaniers, arrived? What did they discover?
Well, the interesting thing is they arrived in Guatemala in 1983 not intending to do this. They went to just look for how can we be helpful, how can we support. And what they found was, after they'd been there a while and gotten to know people, it was the Guatemalans themselves who came to Peace Brigades and said, what you really can do best for us is just be here where they can see you, because we don't think they're going to kill us if you're right in front of them. And so the notion of accompaniment was actually suggested to Peace Brigades by Guatemalan activists, mostly this group that was called the Families of Disappeared, who'd all lost family members, and they were being killed off as well as leaders of this group. And they just said, look, get people down here to be with us. And even though this was the Guatemalan military dictatorship of the 1980s, who seemed to have no limits in what they would do to people, they didn't think they'd kill them while we were with them. And in fact, they didn't. As soon as we started generating a lot of volunteers to go to Guatemala and just stay with all these organizations, the track record was astounding. I mean, all these activists who had been being attacked and killed in the early 80s, the ones who were accompanied by peace brigades, once we started doing this, were able to keep on doing their work.
You just mentioned something that I, from what I've been reading, seems to be a critical part of Peace Brigades International, and that is the whole notion that a peace can't be imposed from the outside, but that it has to be based on the desires of the local people, and it's by request.
Yes. Basically, as Liam's mentioned, a lot of the ideas that we have for our work came from local groups and what makes most sense to them. And our work is driven by them, by what they say would be most helpful for them. A lot of the work we do, we've actually expanded over the years from this first model to become more effective based on that. Some of it is connecting them, bridging and convening, we call it, connecting them to the outside world, to networks, to other human rights activists within a country that they may not have access to. Many of the activists are very isolated, working in isolated areas. And so we have the capability through our international networks that connect them then to the outside world and that have focus on also multi-level diplomacy. So it's another level of the deterrence to the violence that Liam's been talking about, which then becomes connections to United Nations, being able to talk to the European Union, embassies, and having impact and advocacy through grassroots networks and through high-level political contacts. So we may go talk to Congress people or State Department people, and they can write letters or let the country that is endangering these people know what their responsibilities are and that there will be repercussions if these activists are hurt through their work.
Dana Brown, you recently returned from a trip in Colombia as an accompanier. Where were you located?
I was based in the office in Bogota. In Colombia, we have four offices in the different regions of the country. And from the Bogota office, we actually work very nationally, whereas the other offices work regionally. So we intend to cover the entire country and therefore are sometimes in high-level meetings in Bogota, but sometimes on the Ecuadorian border or in the middle of the jungles.
Could you describe the circumstances that necessitated the presence of you and other volunteers in the region when you arrived just over a year ago?
Well, the Colombia Project is actually the oldest and largest of Peace Brigade's projects. We've been in Colombia for 15 years. And the circumstances have certainly changed over that time. But Colombia is still in a civil war. Some people think of it as an internal struggle or a fight against a guerrilla force, but I'd really say that it's a civil war. Among other things, it's the place in the world with the highest rate of the assassination of union leaders. It's a very dangerous place for human rights workers to work. An awful lot of the people that we work with, of the 20 organizations and individuals that we accompany in Colombia, probably a majority of them are displaced from the homes that they originally worked in because of their work. Several of them have also lived in exile for years of their lives. Almost all of them have suffered very credible threats on their lives, some of them attempts on their lives that we can now prove with government documentation, etc. So those are the circumstances in which those people work, and we feel that we can be of use because we have such good relations with the Colombian government and military, and to sort of play a role in not negotiating or dialoguing between those entities, but reminding folks that we're there, in a sense. Like Liam said, being an international presence, raising the profile of the work that these people do to diminish their risk.
Do you have an experience that you can share with us that gives us a vivid picture of what you and your team have done?
Well, one of my most memorable accompaniments was when we accompanied a human rights lawyer that we've worked with for 10 years now, who is based in Bogota but is not originally from Bogota. He and most of his team are from the coast, from the Atlantic coast of the country, and have been displaced because of their work, because of repeated threats on their lives and threats on their family. So this particular lawyer, who's a very well-known lawyer, he was going back to a community that he had worked in previously for the first time in 14 years. And he hadn't gone back because of the risks that he runs in that particular zone of the country, because he's very well known there, because that's where he's from, and because there's a high paramilitary presence in that part of the country. So he'd actually been carrying a case for 14 years without having visited the victims and been able to interview them himself in 14 years. It's an entire community that was displaced by the paramilitary forces and hadn't been able to return to their land. And they were working at the moment that this accompaniment happened a few months ago to return to their land. And he decided that it was finally time for him to go back. And he asked for our accompaniment because he didn't feel comfortable going alone. And he knew that because of the political work we do, we would be raising his profile, that he would know that people knew he was there, and that if something happened, there would be a large reaction. So, and he's a very wonderful, but also a very stoic man. And it was an incredibly emotional experience for me, because as soon as we got there, and it's a long trip, you go on a plane from Bogota to Barranquilla, you get on a bus, you get off the bus in the middle of nowhere, you get on another bus, you get on a boat, you cross the river, and all of a sudden we show up at this tiny little community, and the community itself, everyone is standing on the shore waiting for us, and they run up to him and they say, "Doctor, doctor," they call lawyers doctor in Colombia, and he just bursts into tears. Because he's so overwhelmed by seeing these people that he hasn't been able to see in so long, that he's been terrified to go back and see in person because of the threats that he's received. And here we are with him and with some of the junior lawyers that he works with, shaking hands with these people, and he's bawling. A man that no one I know has ever seen cry. So it was just a gorgeous moment that I think typifies what we're there to do, which is allow people to do the work that they want to be doing so that their country can move forward.
So let's talk about the impact, and Dana just certainly talked about how she witnessed that, of the work that PBI does. Liam, can you give some more instances of where accompaniment has achieved some notable successes?
Well, it's interesting, because one of the tough things about analyzing the impact of accompaniment is that you can only be really certain if you fail, which is, you know, obviously if somebody got killed that we were accompanying, it would be considered quite a failure, although it doesn't happen. But if somebody doesn't get killed or doesn't get hurt, it's kind of hard to prove that it happened because we were there. But if you really look back at the track record, I mean, we started doing this in early 1980s in Guatemala, and then started in 1994 in Colombia. We've literally protected thousands of activists who were on death squad lists over the years in the many countries we've worked. And if you look at the statistics that they actually haven't been killed, it's quite incredible. I mean, it's really, that's not the statistics for people who are not getting this kind of protection. So you can sort of see the effect that way. The other place that I would say you can see a real impact is sort of over the long term. Like, for instance, Peace Brigades went into Colombia in the mid-1990s. Some of the organizations we accompany today in 2010 are literally the same organizations we began accompanying in 1994, 5, and 6. So for 15 years, those organizations have been able to essentially survive and flourish and become, you know, gradually more important fixtures on the political landscape of Colombia to really stand up for people's rights and for what Colombia needs to be. And the same thing happened in my experience in Guatemala, which was from the 1980s all the way through the late 1990s when we were in Guatemala the first period. We accompanied groups that went from working completely in clandestinity where they were in hiding to going public, to creating large movements, to forming parts of a peace process that led to peace accords in the late 1990s. And after those peace accords, some of the people we accompanied went on to become members of Congress in Guatemala. And so you were seeing a whole political transition in which key actors who were trying to fix things were protected and survived to do that.
Catherine Hughes Freytag, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'd like to say that I think another important way to look at the impact, which may not be as quantitative, is to talk to the activists themselves. And when I visited Colombia in October and went with a small group of our volunteers and accompaniers on an international delegation from PBI to see our program there, and we went up into the jungle on donkeys, 2 or 3 hours up into the rainforest in northeastern Colombia, and met with the elders and the council members who ran the San Jose de Apartado Peace Community, which is a whole group of people that we accompanied back to their lands that they'd been forcibly displaced from in 1997. They went back in. And Senor Wilson, who's one of the senior members of the group, you know, told us and told me that without Peace Brigades International, we would never have had the courage to come back in and do this. We had the will, we had the knowledge, but with Peace Brigades International there by our side to be able to go back in, to know that the world would know if we were attacked, which they have been a number of times, but they have persevered and they have expanded their peace community now to about 12 local areas that are looking at organic farming and other ways of sustaining themselves. We would not have been able to do this. The same thing I heard from Afro-Colombians who also went back from refugee camps into areas that they'd been displaced with, and PBI was there with them on the boats to accompany them, to be there as a presence and a witness as they did these amazingly courageous acts. In Mexico, I heard the same things from environmentalists up in the Guerrero Mountains and La Montaña, that we would not have been able to either get out of prison because PBI made it aware that we were there and being tortured, and then be able to stand by us and be a presence for when we took these courageous steps to reclaim our land, to make peace for our communities, and to stand up for what is right. So I think that's another important aspect to look at.
Catherine Hughes Freytag, Executive Director of Peace Brigades International. And we're also hearing from other PBI associates, Liam Mahoney and Dana Brown, as we explore the international peacekeeping technique of unarmed accompaniment. We'll have more from our PBI guests, and later on, we'll hear from Mel Duncan of the Nonviolent Peace Force, which is working in Sri Lanka and the Philippines. All when we continue on Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. More after this break.
Hello, loyal listeners. I'm Jesse Mason.
I'm Tyler Duncan.
I'm Mike Shimon.
I'm Brad Phillips.
And we're the band Millish. Yeah. You're listening to 89.3 FM, WHFR.FM.
You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution strategies. Online with scores of episodes on still timely topics dating back to 2003. Visit peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com for more. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, along with Carol Boss, who continues her conversation now with three members of Peace Brigades International, the non-governmental organization that provides unarmed bodyguards and other support services to people working for peace and human rights in troubled nations like Colombia, Mexico, Indonesia, Nepal, and more. We'll hear more now from Catherine Hughes Freytag, Executive Director of PBI, Dana Brown, a volunteer back recently from an assignment in Colombia, and Liam Mahoney, co-author of the book Unarmed Bodyguards, International Accompaniment for the Protection of Human Rights.
Has PBI been challenged at all on the effectiveness of its techniques? Perhaps there are others who believe there are better ways to achieve the goals.
I think there's two different kinds of challenges, actually. The main challenge is is the challenge posed to us by those who want to attack these activists, which is there's all sorts of both subtle and direct intimidations and threats and hindrances that are put in the way. For instance, we've had countries where we've worked where all of a sudden the government makes it really hard for us to get visas and get anybody in because they don't want us in there doing that. We've had all kinds of, you know, quiet threats against our teams in different places. And those are all kind of calling into question, well, the whole idea, well, are we really making people safer if they're attacking us? But if you look at it the other way around, every time that one of these states or other parties tries to sort of intimidate our presence, in a sense, they're saying they don't want us there because it's working. So on that, that's one key challenge. I think that's the biggest challenge. I think the other challenge I mentioned, which is if you're in a place for a really long time, it's not so easy to prove that what we do works, okay? What the main proof that Catherine mentioned earlier is the activists truly believe it works and they feel very encouraged and build their movements much more powerfully because they have this presence with them. But it's not like you're going to walk up to some dictator and he's going to say, oh, well, you know, we were going to kill that guy, but we didn't because you were standing next to him. You don't get that kind of proof of impact. It's pretty hard to find. Although there's a few instances that are quite interesting in that respect. We had one case about 7 or 8 years ago in Colombia where Peace Brigade's volunteers were staying the night in the home of a local human rights activist who was in great danger. And a death squad came and knocked on the door and broke into the house to take him away. And the Peace Brigade's volunteers basically stood up right in front and introduced themselves and said they were an international organization that was there to make sure that human rights were respected. And the death squad turned around and left. And that's really rare, in part possibly because accompaniment works so well, which is to say, most of the time, they don't even come and knock on the door because our assumption is they know the people we're with are being accompanied, and they've already made that calculation. And so there's so many instances of success that I would say we can't really document. We don't know how many times they don't knock on the door.
This is Dana. Can I just add one thing to what Liam said? I think the emotional aspect of our presence is extremely important, at least what I heard in the field in Colombia from the people that we work with and whose work we support, is that in part, sometimes the decision not to go into exile or not to be displaced from their community or to continue prosecuting a certain case is in part because they feel accompanied, because they know they can call on us 24 hours a day, 24/7, that they can show up at our house, that they have 15 cell phone numbers and a landline for us, that whatever happens to them, we have offices in Brussels, in Washington, D.C., that there are 29 country groups around the world that will lobby on their behalf. It's the fact that they know that they can count on us. And that, to me, is a huge success because we're relying on these people to change their own countries and their own situations. And if they feel that they have to flee to other countries, that they're not safe to be there, then in a sense we failed. But if they're able to make that decision, and somewhat on an emotional level, that they feel accompanied, that they're able to continue their work, to me that's a huge success. And that happens every day, that people don't leave.
What can listeners take from these stories and these techniques, and how can they apply them to their lives and their own personal conflicts?
This is one of the things that I think that the Peace Brigade experience has demonstrated, is that very often, you know, people who are doing things that you think are bad are a lot more sensitive than you think they are. I mean, almost every place we've gone and tried to do this kind of work, people at first have said, this will never work, they're crazy, they just kill people, they don't listen. You know, whether they're saying it's, you know, military dictators in Guatemala or, you know, drug-crazed paramilitary assassins in Colombia, the assumption at first is, by many people, this won't work, and therefore people don't try. But the key dynamic of what we do is we're basically saying, having someone be accompanying someone who's in trouble and watching and observing and stepping in some way to sort of aid them is actually something that those who are attacking them pay attention to. And if you look at that locally and domestically, there's tons of examples where, I mean, one example that occurs to me is after 9/11, for instance, there were a lot of immigrant communities in the United States who were under attack, particularly Arab communities in the United States. And there were Peace Brigade's volunteers and other community people
all over the country who were trying to figure out ways for non-Arab communities to accompany those people who were being threatened, to sort of show that they were not alone and that, you know, they couldn't be singled out and marginalized. And that's basically accompaniment at a domestic level. And it can happen at a personal and community level as well. And this is something that I think you can just generalize this dynamic, which is if one community that's not under attack, one set of people that are not under attack, step in and stand beside those who are under attack, those who are attacking them are likely to have a second thought and think about it.
I think another important and very powerful for me impact of Peace Brigade's international work and nonviolent strategy in general is the fact that we believe that nonviolence, as Gandhi said, is a transformative tool. So it's not just about winning something or enforcing power over someone. We're really looking at protecting these communities that are trying to transform. And I spoke with one of our volunteers, an Italian volunteer actually in Mexico, and he said to me, you know, I couldn't do this kind of work. I couldn't work with Peace Brigades International and talk to dictators and talk to defense directors who I know have tortured these friends and these people that were working within their families unless I truly believed that there was a good part of every human being, that there was something inside that could be reached and could be transformed. And I think that's another important aspect in our everyday work with people that we have conflict with people politically that we're up against or disagree with, that we really believe all of us has something very good and human in each of us, and that that can be transformed, and that there's a way to shift that through nonviolent strategy and modeling and working for peace.
Dana, did you have any ideas you wanted to add?
Sure. I would just say that for everyone, whatever kind of work they do, I hope that PBI can be one of many examples that nonviolence works, that even in highly conflictive situations, there is a power to nonviolence that is transcendent. So even if the lesson that people come away with is, how can I be nonviolent in my own life? How can I employ nonviolent communication techniques with my partner, my family, my community? I think that we can be a lesson, our model, not only on an international level, but on a very local level. We're also an organization that works by consensus. And in the Columbia Project, it's very difficult at times. We're 65 people from all over the world with all sorts of different backgrounds and with very passionate ideals about who we are and what we're doing in the field. And we don't do almost anything without coming to a consensus first. And so a lot of what we learn about ourselves and about each other is how to interact peacefully, how to speak with one another, how to come to consensus and to be an organization that reflects what we want in the world. And I'm not saying that it's easy, but I think that there are an awful lot of lessons that we can learn there about how to be nonviolent from a very internal point to all of our interactions with our colleagues, our coworkers, our housemates, and the world we live in.
Why is it important for Americans to care about human rights in other countries, such as Colombia or Guatemala, for example?
I believe it's very important for us as Americans. We have a huge impact on the world. The countries that we're working in, Mexico, Guatemala, Colombia, Nepal, and Indonesia right now, and we need to make sure that those countries and our presence in those countries is actually a positive presence for peace, for development, for supporting communication and work that has a positive impact.
Well, I think a key thing as to why it matters is to Americans is as to anyone else is basically moral. It's just that there's a lot of people who are hurting, who are in danger, and there are things that we could do. And I think the main reason that many, many people do not get engaged in these kinds of issues that are far away in other places where they, in fact, may hear that people are in pain and suffering, is not because they don't care. It's because they feel it's futile and they don't actually know what they could do or what would work. And that's why I think, you know, one of the things that Peace Brigades is trying to show is that there really are things you can do and that we can do. And there actually is a lot of others that we're not doing. And the key thing is if people felt that there were things they could do that worked and helped, and if they could see that difference, a lot more people would be getting engaged in these struggles to support people who are under threat around the world.
Dana, I want to ask you something. As an American who went over as a volunteer to be a protective accompanier in Colombia, Did your experience change your life?
It's a big question. I'd say absolutely. I think there's no way for an experience like PBI and a year in the field in Colombia to not change your life. And as I think I sort of touched on before, it happens at a lot of levels. One of them is very personal, and it's about what you learn about yourself, about your limitations, your strengths, your affinity for people in the world, your ability to liaise with different people from different walks of life, etc. And it's also about emotionally what you can endure, seeing things in the field that horrify you and depress you, and then again getting the motivation to continue to work because of what you see and the strength of the people around you.
Catherine, let me ask you, who is volunteering for PBI, and how does one connect with the organization?
Yeah, great question. We would love to have more volunteers. We have volunteers from all over the world. We've been talking about that, both the Global North, North America and Europe, as well as in the Global South. We have about 75-plus volunteers around the world in teams at any one time. And in the U.S., we always have a number of people interested. We do volunteer orientation weekends about twice a year, usually in Washington, D.C., and then in the West Coast or somewhere in between. And you can get in touch with us at www.pbiusa.org to find out more about how you can volunteer. People go in for a year is the minimum commitment. We're looking for people that are around 25 at the youngest, because we want maturity. And as you've heard, there's a lot of responsibility and life and death matters that people are taking on. But we have people up to 70 that are volunteering with us. So we have a wide diversity. And about 15% of the volunteers in the countries of conflict are from the U.S. at any one time, 10 to 15%. So there are a lot of international volunteers as well.
Has Peace Brigades International been a pioneer in creative approaches to peacemaking?
I would say definitely yes. We are one of the longest and oldest, longest running and largest in the world protective accompaniment organizations.
One other thing, though, I think is crucial here is that, I mean, if you look at accompaniment as a tool, as a creative tactic, well, it's not new anymore. It's been going on now for nearly 30 years, even just within peace brigades. But where the real creative peacemaking is happening is on the ground by the civil society groups that we're trying to protect. So in a sense, the key contribution of accompaniment to creative peacemaking is that it's allowing people to develop creative tools at the local level and national level who otherwise might be being killed for trying.
And I would actually just like to add to what Catherine said about our kind of non-interventionist stance and the idea that Peace Brigades is there to support work that local human rights defenders are doing and not to impose a solution. I want to say that as a field volunteer, I chose PBI very much because of that stance, because of that political decision to go in as foreigners to support local people's initiatives for peace and not to come with our own agenda. One, I believe, to me, morally, it feels like something that I'm in alignment with, but also I believe it's very strategic, and I think that the reception that we have as internationals, especially in a country like Colombia, where there's been so much foreign intervention, I think that we are able to have high-level conversations with the Colombian government, the Colombian military, the civil authorities, and the foreign embassies, in part because we don't tell the organizations that we work with what to do and what not to do. We don't necessarily support their campaigns. We're there to uphold international humanitarian law and monitor the human rights situation so that these people can do the work that they legally and rightfully do.
That's Dana Brown, a volunteer field worker for Peace Brigades International, the non-governmental organization that specializes in supplying unarmed bodyguards to peace and human rights workers some of the most conflict-ridden and dangerous countries in the world. We also heard from PBI's executive director, Catherine Hughes Freitek, and Liam Mahoney, a longtime PBI worker and author of the book Unarmed Bodyguards, International Accompaniment for the Protection of Human Rights. We're exploring the use of unarmed bodyguards in conflict regions today on Peace Talks Radio, and next up, Mel Duncan of the Nonviolent Peace Force, right after this break.
Thank you. Island Park. And you're listening to WHFR, the only station making waves.
You can sign up for a free Peace Talks Radio podcast or newsletter at our website, peacetalksradio.com, where you can also hear this program again or dozens of other episodes on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution strategies, all at peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, today with Carol Boss. In 2005 on this program, Carol talked with the director of another international peace-promoting organization that at the time was just getting off the ground. The Nonviolent Peace Force had taken on as its pilot project the unsettled situation in Sri Lanka, where a somewhat tenuous Norwegian-negotiated peace accord was holding down unrest between the Sri Lankan government and the Tamil Tiger opposition group. Mel Duncan was the Nonviolent Peace Force executive director at the time. Now he coordinates outreach for the organization that has expanded its project work to the Philippines and Sudan.
We started in 2003 when we were invited by a group of civil society organizations. They believed at that time, because of the ceasefire agreement, that there was an opportunity to start to knit back together the foundation that would bring about peace. So they asked Nonviolent Peace Force to deploy a team of peacekeepers who would work with them, provide civilian protection, and help protect that space so that the local peacemakers and human rights defenders could do their work and could stay alive. And then in 2008, the government of Sri Lanka abrogated the ceasefire agreement, and things deteriorated very rapidly from there on. In the spring of 2009, especially in April and May, there was all-out war in the north that resulted in the elimination of the political and military leadership of the Tamil Tigers, and about 280,000 people being interred for a number of months.
What happened then, if anything, with the role of the peace force there in Sri Lanka?
Well, the demand for our services intensified as the war intensified. We provided protection for various people who were caught up in the midst of the war. We also worked with people who were internally displaced, who were being detained in camps, and trying to get into those camps and to work with them as they left and were relocated. In the aftermath of the war, we have continued to work with a group of 50 human rights defenders and providing them with protection and support as they sort things out and try to build back a foundation to their society. We are working with villages that are under that have been under threat to help them to develop their own protection plans and so that they are able to again start to become functional. In addition to that, we continue to work with the return of child soldiers. In Sri Lanka, there was a rampant use of children, forcing them to fight at early ages, often at the age of 12 or 13. And now as these children return, we assist in their reintegration into communities that are not always welcoming.
I remember when we spoke last a few years ago, you talked about the mothers of kidnapped sons.
That's right.
And they approached your organization for help.
That's right, Carol. And we did a considerable amount of accompaniment of mothers who would actually go to the camps with our peacekeepers with them and successfully gain the release of their sons and daughters who had been abducted and were being forced to become child soldiers. And what was very interesting with that is as the mothers gained confidence, they started to organize and started to work in larger groups so as to protect their children from being abducted and to gain their release.
What are some of the things most successful about the project in Sri Lanka, the accomplishments that have truly heartened you? And maybe you can give us a story to illustrate.
In addition to the return and the protection of child soldiers, which was very heartening, there's been a number of other situations. For example, we provided protective accompaniment for a number of journalists. And as I'm sure you know, journalism is an increasingly dangerous profession in various parts of the world, including Sri Lanka. We also, in one case in eastern Sri Lanka, provided the space for shopkeepers from the Muslim community and the Tamil community to come together and to do some very simple peace-building work between the two of them. This was very simple, and I think it was three or four sessions. But what happened was a few months after that, when there was a political assassination, violence started to spread. And so these shopkeepers, when violence was getting to the outskirts of their area, simply crossed the street. And the Muslim shopkeepers stood in the Tamil shops, and the Tamil shopkeepers stood in the Muslim shops, therefore preventing any of the shops from being burned. So this is a simple kind of peacekeeping and empowerment that leads to communities better able to protect themselves.
What about any disappointments?
Well, I think that the biggest disappointment that we soberly faced in Sri Lanka was that we were not able to stop a war. That in that case, when there are two parties that are intent up on fighting and killing one another, that there are very limited things that we can do. What we're coming to grips with is that to do peacekeeping, there has to be a peace to keep. And we can, first of all, work with those individuals and groups in communities that are committed to building the peace, and secondly, to help create the space for that to happen. But that at this stage in our development, that we are not able to stop a full-scale war from breaking out.
Wanted to give listeners a sense of the strategies used by the nonviolent peace force. I know there are four essential strategies.
Yes, and it's actually expanded a bit since we last talked, Carol. The strategies include accompaniment of providing a well-trained civilian peacekeeper to accompany people who are directly under threat because of the war that they are involved in. This is often people who are working on peacemaking or human rights defense or journalists. So accompaniment really amounts to providing unarmed bodyguards. In addition to that, we provide proactive presence where our teams will live and work in the areas that are experiencing the most violence. And so by being in those areas, we provide a deterrence to violence continuing. In addition to that, we provide interpositioning where we will place our teams between two conflicting parties to provide a buffer and a cooling off period.
Can you give an example of how this has worked in practice?
Yes. In Mindanao, in the southern Philippines, there were two combatant forces that were converging on a village of about 1,000 people. The people started to pack up their things and flee. The elders in the village called in one of our teams, and so our team went to the village as the two conflicting parties were converging on that village. En route, our team leader called on cell phone, and in this modern world, the military leaders are all on cell phone, so called the commanders of both of these factions, saying that we were sending an international team into the village and that we would stay there with the people so that they would not have to flee their homes, and that we expected both combatant groups to back off, and indeed they did.
You said there was an expansion of strategies since we last talked about 5 years ago.
Yes. Additionally, our teams do monitoring of ceasefire agreements. So, for example, again, in Mindanao in the southern Philippines, we have been invited to be part of the official international monitoring team for a ceasefire agreement that is in place there. This is an advance because usually it is only nation states that are part of these international monitoring teams. In addition to that, we play an important role at bridging at this point, of bridging local organizations and people who are working on reconciliation and peace to other entities such as ambassadors or the European Union or the UN, so that these organizations working at the ground level can have direct access to the higher diplomatic channels that are taking place.
Do you think nonviolent peace force will forever be employed?
Yes. One of the heartbreaking things about my job is that we always receive many more invitations than we can respond to. And what we're seeing is that as we build the capacity for our peacekeepers, and I want to point out that they are not volunteers, they are well-trained, paid professional peacekeepers. Their minimum commitment is for 2 years. They go through rigorous training. They come from throughout the world, from both the global north and the global south. As we build this ability, that we will replace the world's tendencies to try to do peacemaking and peace building from the barrel of a gun, and instead seeing that well-trained international peacekeepers working with firmly rooted organizations in those areas can be much more effective in laying a foundation for a sustainable peace. So we clearly see at this point that there is a rising demand for our services, and that that will continue to increase as organizations and nation states and multilateral organizations recognize that well-trained civilians can play a very important role in keeping the peace.
How have you seen things change since the beginnings of Nonviolent Peace Force?
I think that one of the biggest changes is that we have a growing number of people who want to do this work. Routinely, we have 10 applicants for every peacekeeper spot that we have available. And people are coming from throughout the world who want to do this work. Secondly, we're seeing that in the field, we have to be much more specialized. So, for example, with our team in Mindanao, now that we have been given a role for civilian protection, we are having to recruit people who have backgrounds in civilian protection and who have specific backgrounds in international humanitarian law. So that we're moving more away from the generalists and into people who have very specific experiences and education. In addition to that, I think the most important thing that we've learned in the field is that our peacekeeping is based upon trust and relationship. Now, while we have to be well-trained, we have to be disciplined in following our mandate, we have to be strategic, we also see that peacekeeping really flows from a trusting relationship. And so our teams need to be in areas for longer periods of time as they build this relationship with people in the community and then work with them as those people build the peace in their areas. What we're finding now is that there's much more of a receptivity and understanding of unarmed civilian peacekeeping. When we started, very few people understood that term. We would get very puzzled, if not hostile, looks when we would bring that up. Today, we are now engaging in consultations with the United Nations, with the European Union, with the Organization of Islamic Conference, and a number of other, both multilateral as well as nation states, who see that this is a reasonable policy option and therefore needs to be supported. Needs to be supported through civil society groups like Nonviolent Peace Force, but also to start to look at how the UN can use its own personnel to provide more unarmed civilian peacekeepers as opposed to the 120,000 armed peacekeepers that they currently deploy.
Last time we spoke, you said this: what we have found as we worked in various parts of the world was that there are creative and courageous peacemakers in the most violent places in the world today. Can you give us a story, an example?
In Guatemala, where we had a peacekeeping team who provided protection for a women's human rights defenders unit. And in that case, our team was there for 10 months and provided protection for these women as they continued to do the necessary work to uncover the genocide that took place there. These women called on us when they went to their office one day to find that their office had been broken into, that there was a noose hanging from the ceiling, their computers had been stolen, and various women had gotten very graphic threats on their cell phones. We were able to provide one-on-one accompaniers to these women as they continued to do their work. They would have continued to do that work whether we were there or not. And that's the inspiring part. And there are men and women, more often than not women, who are doing this work at this very moment in the most violent place in the world today. And so by us being there, we were able to provide them with support and protection so they would have more confidence and safety in being able to carry out their work. And so as you and I, as people in civil society, which just means regular people throughout the world, we really have a responsibility and an opportunity to reach out to them and to provide them with the support and the protection that they need so that they can continue to do the courageous and creative peace-building and human rights work that they're doing at this very moment.
Now, when we last spoke, you told us what I would call a moving story, that you, as a professional peacemaker, was having to see off your own son.
Oh, yes.
Who volunteered for military duty in Iraq, and that was hard for you. How is your son doing?
Well, he did return after a year in Iraq, where he served as a member of the National Guard. He has struggled since then with drug addiction and with a number of other problems. And I'm happy to say today that he is clean and is working through a rehab program at the Veterans Administration, and currently, just in the past week, passed his nurse's assistant training, and so is working on the oncology wing at the Veterans Hospital. I think, Carol, what this points out is that our son and tens of thousands of men and women, some young, some not so young, are returning with very deep wounds, some of which are very visible and some are not. And that the services are woefully inadequate to deal with the post-traumatic stress, with the drug problems, with the adjustment problems that people are having as they return from Afghanistan and Iraq. And I would urge that all of us, as we look to sending more men and women into harm's way, that we include in the upfront costs the costs of supporting and caring for them when they return.
Mel Duncan is the Director of Outreach and former Executive Director of the Nonviolent Peace Force. To read more about their work across the globe, as well as to learn more about Peace Brigades International, which we featured earlier, look for links on our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear this program again, as well as hear all of the programs in our series dating back to 2003. You can also order CDs there, sign up for a free podcast or monthly newsletter, and importantly, it's where you can find out how you can keep this particular program on the air by making a tax-deductible contribution to the nonprofit media organization that produces the show. Your dollars really do make a difference. Find out more about doing your part at peacetalksradio.com. Additional support comes from the Oppenheimer Brothers Foundation, AMP Concerts, Albuquerque's roving concert series at ampconcerts.org, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Ali Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For Carol Boss, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thank you for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.
Good. Okay. All right. Hey. All right. So, you're floating in a tin can with me, Jimmy. I'm your non-resident spaceman. Brought to you courtesy of the good people at WHFR Dearborn. 89.3 FM and on the internet at WHFR.FM. Well. Okay. Yeah. No, thank you. Magical Notebook, you are one class act. So I'm your non-resident spaceman. Brought you across space and time just to keep things interesting and confused. I don't completely understand myself, but I'm in your future, you're in my past, and I have music to play. So, that said, let's see.